announced that we have Mr. Vedgery receiving per se. And Mr. West for Ms. Fulton Monet.
That's correct.
Mr. Vedgery, you have 15 minutes to argue your case. You can save any amount of time that you want for rebuttal. I always like to sort of say this to pro se people, you know, that you presented your case well enough and brief, is that this court's more concerned with legal arguments as opposed to consideration of the factual circumstances involved in the case. I can rest assured that all three judges have read the briefs and understand the facts. And so if you could focus on the legal arguments, that would be best for you making your presentation to this court, sir.
I will. Definitely.
You may begin with that, sir.
Thank you. If I could have a couple minutes reserved for rebuttal.
Yes, sir. 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very good. Good morning, Judge O'Brien, Judge Alston, Judge Clements. Lauren's the most important person in my life, so I'm grateful for the opportunity to better preserve my place in hers. I want to take my allotted time to address some of the points that Appellee made in her opposition brief. My response to dismissal required for failure to cite the pages or preserve or alter assignments of error. The first third of the Appellee's brief argues that the appeal should be dismissed based on technicalities. For example, they argue that dismissal is warranted due to my supposed failure to cite to the exact spot in the record where the objection was preserved. To be clear, the vast majority of the errors do contain proper citations of the record. And to the extent that they don't, I'd be happy to file a supplement with this court to ease its review. But either way, the law is clear that dismissal is not mandated for failure to cite the exact place in the record. See Brooks versus Commonwealth, 61 Virginia at 576. They also ask that the appeal be dismissed because I altered the language of some of the assignments of error when I filed my brief. But they can't identify any prejudice that resulted from that. They say that it impacted their ability to properly prepare and designate appropriate portions of the record. But they had weeks to file their opposition brief, and they could easily have designated additional parts of the record. Appellee also faults me for failing to file a contemporaneous objection to the June 9, 2016 order, but she concedes that I objected at a subsequent hearing that was designed to finalize that order, opposition brief at 20. The record is clear in this regard. The court and the parties were still hashing out and making amendments to the order. The law requires an appellant to object to final orders, not tentative ones. And that is precisely what I did. You can refer to Nussbaum versus Berlin, 273 Virginia, 385. These contentions are, in short, nothing more than red herrings that distract from the underlying issue. The real issue are the myriad ways in which the trial court abused its discretion. As explained in my brief, the trial court failed to reopen the evidence without justification, which prevented me from introducing evidence that Appellee assaulted me. They say that the trial court validly exercised its discretion in refusing to reopen the evidence because the evidence would not have been material. That's plainly wrong. The trial court based her custody order in large part on the view that I was the aggressor, that I bore primary responsibility for the altercations. But the assault that I sought to introduce into evidence would have called that assumption into question. It would have tended to establish that Appellee has borne equal, if not greater, responsibility for the fights. And it would have undermined her and her witness's testimony that I have temper problems. Unable to dispute its materiality, Appellee says that the trial court correctly refused to admit the evidence because it would have caused, quote, prejudice, delay, and confusion. Neither the trial court nor Appellee bothered to articulate how prejudice, delay, or confusion would result. Apparently, Appellee thinks it would result from her decision to contest my and the police officer's account of the assault. But an opposing party's intention to dispute material evidence is not a basis for excluding that evidence altogether. As for the trial court's decision not to interview Lauren, Appellee argues that I failed to preserve the issue on appeal, but that's a gross misrepresentation of what happened. My attorney filed a request for the trial court to conduct an in-camera interview. The court decided to defer that motion until the end of the trial, at which point it and the parties would revisit its necessity. At the end of the trial, I decided to renew my request that the court conduct the interview. Appellee also argues in her brief that the court was not only obligated to consider the reasonable preference of Lauren if it found that she was the age of discretion, but as I explained in my brief, excuse me, also argues in her brief that the court was only obligated to consider the reasonable preference of Lauren if it found that she was of the age of discretion. But as I explained in my brief, a court cannot make such a finding without actually interviewing a child. And for that reason, every court in Virginia to consider the issue has found that a court that refuses to at least conduct an in-camera interview abuses its discretion. As for the provision barring Lauren from playing golf for a year.
Let me interrupt you here.
Yes, ma'am.
Counsel, the time that you wanted the trial judge to interview Lauren was 10, is that right?
Correct.
Correct. Oh, thank you.
As for the provision barring Lauren from playing golf for a year, appellee assertion that there is an abundance of evidence supporting the one-year ban on competitive golf is far-fetched at best. Contrary to her suggestion, I never consented to such an absolute ban. In fact, if you look to page 221 of the record, which is the page that appellee cites in support of her argument, the trial court asked me a bizarre hypothetical question. If I had a choice between more golf or more time with my daughter, what would I choose? I said I would choose the latter. But no one at the time had suggested that Lauren might be barred for a year from playing competitive golf. Had the purpose of the question been apparent, I would have responded that the two are obviously not mutually exclusive. And at any rate, I objected to that provision of the order as soon as the trial court issued the ban. Appellee also argues unconvincingly that the ban was justified because golf has been a constant source of consternation for Florence and me. That may be true, but no more so than any other aspect of our admittedly troubled relationship. By that logic, Lauren should be banned from doing all the things that Florence and I have failed to see eye to eye on. School, sports games, the selection of a godmother, or traveling. It's a gross abuse of discretion to single out golfing in particular, given the wealth of testimony showing that Lauren is a prodigy and could easily become a professional. In barring Lauren from playing golf, the trial court gave zero consideration to her exceptional talent at the game, to the detrimental effect that a year off could have on her skills, or to Lauren's wishes. Had she been called to testify, she would have confirmed her desire to play.
So may I ask you,
sure,
when did the provision for not to play competitive golf begin?
I believe it was the first time that was mentioned was May 2nd, the first time we met back into court after our two closing pleas and about 2 weeks after the initial testimony. So that was the first time. Then there were three subsequent follow-ups. And then the final order was signed, I believe, was June 9th.
But as a practical matter, when did that begin?
I don't know. That's a question. I mean, is it May 2nd? Is it June 9th? Lauren hasn't played in anything since, I believe, it was March. And she only played 2 9-hole tournaments in the spring of 2016. So essentially, she's lost 4 seasons. And the last time before that was the end of 2015, maybe October. So that's kind of about the timeline of things. And certainly if we want to at least address that, if I can do so without losing particular parts of time, the 25 to 26 tournaments was a mischaracterization. She played 19 tournaments in 2015. She won 15. And I constantly would have to ask, well, Lauren needs the 4th tournament to qualify for the World Championships. So I'd have to ask and ask and ask. And she only, out of 15 requests, over a 2-year period, she allowed her to play in 1 tournament in Herndon in 2014 and 1 tournament in 2015. So those amount of requests, the circuit court judge thought, well, I want her to play in 25, 26 tournaments, which was just patently untrue. Okay. So if I may. Finally, I want to advise the court of another matter. Part of trial court's decision was based on my supposed ability to cooperate in the co-parenting agreement, factor 7, opposition brief at 26. In particular, Pelley claims that I refused to agree to a parental coordinator, but let me make this point out. Who would you bet on who would fire the parental coordinator? After 4 attempted restraining orders over a 5-year period, all dismissed, who would you bet on who would fire the parental coordinator 3 months ago? Not me. So we have other issues that are going to be continuing. So my relationship with Appellee has been far from perfect, and I acknowledge that I bear some of the responsibility for its breakdown. But the current order goes too far. It strips me of my parental rights without hearing from Lauren, without considering critical evidence calling Appellee's character into question. And it barred Lauren from cultivating a 1-in-a-million talent without any justification. So what we're left with.
So let me ask you a question, and I understand what you're saying, and I'll say for the record, I'm a golfer too, so I enjoy the game. And I understand that if you think you have a child with talent, that you want that child to have the opportunity to advance, and this is a critical time for that child developing the opportunity to be a very good golfer. But it seems to me from reviewing the record on this matter and listening to what the trial court was saying, is that the trial court made a factual determination that maybe we need a break at this golfing for the benefit of the child, for the benefit of the relationship, for the benefit of everything, that we need a little bit of a hiatus so to let things settle down. Is the trial court wrong in exercising its discretion to say that we may need a break here to accomplish what should be the goal, and that is accomplishing the best interest of the child?
Well, I would disagree with that. The appellee has my daughter Lauren in 17 hours of extracurriculars every 2 weeks. We play golf 6.5 hours every 2 weeks, 60 to 90 minutes on Wednesdays, the only night that we have together, and then every other weekend, which may be 3 to 3.5 hours combined, 6.5 hours. She has her in 11 hours in gymnastics every 2 weeks, but then there are claims, well, she's tired. Well, golf has a stigma for being an old man's game, so how can you be tired from golf?
And you're playing. I like to play golf, so don't call him an old man.
Well, would you be more tired from 11 hours of gymnastics, or would you be more tired from 6.5 hours of golf? Yet Lauren and I are stigmatized because she's tired, she's late night playing golf, all these things that are just ridiculous. I mean, so in terms of the appellee has taken her to other golf pros. I objected. She took her to a PGA Junior League. I'm her caddy, but I objected to that. So yeah, I've objected, but the one thing that's never happened is she never takes her to practice putting and chipping at the Trump National Club. And Lauren asked, but she doesn't do that. She's always doing other activities. So Lauren and I, she loves baking, cooking, ripsticking. We toss the frisbee. We do a ton of different things. Golf is not it. So certainly that's mischaracterized.
So is it your view, sir, that the judge's action in this case by removing golf from the formula was punitive in nature? Is that your position?
Absolutely. And we can also be punitive about 5 overnights reduced to 4 overnights. 3 weeks vacation, we're taken down to 2 weeks vacation. Christmas Day, I no longer have every other year. There's bands and gymnastics because my daughter wants to sit on my lap when there's 7 girls waiting on one trampoline, so she comes out and sits on my lap, so she gets banned because there was some questionable interaction between the judge and one of the appellee's friends. So there were constant ways to take away whatever I had with Lauren. You know, 4 overnights every 2 weeks is 28% of the time. That's almost 1/4 of the time. So everything was reduced. It's like saying, like Robert De Niro, you. And that's the way it felt. And I think that's what the record indicates. Everything was curtailed. And she can't do that because you made her into a prodigy. How can that be? So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, sir.
6.5 hours versus 17 hours, 11 hours of gymnastics and such. So I move 1 mile from Lauren's school from an hour away. I had 5 overnights. Now all of a sudden after the circuit court, it's 4 overnights. So things are reduced. I don't think that's equitable. So we're here to find out what the best interests of Lauren are. Losing time, losing vacation. 4 protective orders have been dismissed. Firing of the parental coordinator was appointed by the lower court judge. So I want to, and as we, I believe I have a couple minutes left. That's my rebuttal, so I'm going into my rebuttal time.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Judge Irby says, quote, it's fair that neither party can co-parent. In order to co-parent, there has to be a certain level of maturities on both sides, and when that does not exist, one party ends up with more time and more responsibility of making decisions. And that's just the way it's going to be. And it doesn't matter who's at fault. That's just the way it's going to be. If the adults can't behave, then the minor child's best interest in one party's time is going to be minimized. Page 622. So we've talked about the motion to reopen. I was looked upon as the villain because she was granted TRO because I filed my cross-protective TRO by affidavit. So I came into the court looking like I was the one who had problems. So she said, you have anger problems. You have alcohol problems. That's just not what happened. She was charged with a Class 1 assault and battery misdemeanor. So all of my objections were shown on, say, pages 637 to 639, and I will leave it at that. So I've asked for this to be remanded and that for the circuit court judge to step down from future proceedings. Wish for things to be vacated, all for the best interest of my daughter. Thank you.
Thank you. About half a minute as well, so.
Thank you.
If you please the court, my name is Brian Weston. I represent the appellee in this case. And this is quite an interesting and remarkable case for what it represents. And what it represents here is an individual who has, over a long period of years, engaged in a long pattern of abuse, which has not only been in the actual physical sense, in that he did break my client's nose, where a protective order was issued, but also in a real psychological sense and in a legal sense, for this has been ongoing, continuous assault in the throughout the courts of Maryland, the lower courts of Virginia, the circuit courts of Virginia, and now here again.
Mr. Wes, let me interrupt you.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate you setting your client's position out with zeal. Mr. Vetri read something from the court transcript in the matter, which was rather interesting to me, and I think I'm paraphrasing now, that the court said that when the parents cannot behave, basically saying both of them had some degree of fault, I'm not getting into, you know, what percentage of fault each one has, but when the parents behave, essentially what she says is, I'm going to remove one of them significantly from the determinations and the life of the child. Is that the standard that we should use in resolving these cases? Because I can't remember a domestic relations case involving a custody dispute where someone was upset with the result.
I think that's right.
But is it right just because the parents don't get involved that one parent suffer the disadvantage of being a hooked child's life?
So in a case without any additional facts, and you said, we're just going to pick one of the two of you we're going to have to lose in this, without some exacerbating facts, I would say that would be an abuse of discretion. But that's not what happened in this case. And it's interesting Mr. Vetri stops reading, because the facts in this case suggest there is ample reason for the court to have made the determination that she did in applying the factors. And interesting, the page which he referred you to ended at 622, but if you were to go on to 623, you would have heard the court state the following. And I'm going to say it again. The behaviors that you have engaged in speaking about, Mr. Vetri, are beyond the pale. Getting tased at your daughter's baptism in a church? I don't know. You can't make this stuff up. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I heard the testimony. I understand your defense. But that never should have gotten to the point where the police had to be called. Never, never should have happened. This last incident at Lauren's soccer game, I understand she was videotaping. I understand that you found it offensive, but you were trying to remove a phone and ended up rolling on the grounds on the soccer field. Can you imagine? Put yourself in your daughter's situation, both of you in your daughter's place. She's there in front of her friends, colleagues, and coaches. She's 10. She's 10. She wants to play soccer. She wants to have a good time. She wants to excel. Everything but he says that she's a fantastic athlete, a great kid, and she's humiliated by her parents. Now, the items that she spoke to are, in each instance, the actions which Mr. Vetri engaged in. And I've been doing this for now 31 years. I've never heard of an individual going to his child's baptism at the age of 7 and being arrested and tased in front of his child and the whole community and her family. Can you imagine the embarrassment that poor little girl had to go through? He then was convicted and spent 17 days in jail because of his unwillingness to comport himself in a fashion that society expects from its participants, its members. He is unable to contain himself in this exercise. His brief, I suggest to Your Honor, is a further example of an individual unconstrained by the rules, and he belittles us for saying it's hyper-technical to say, where is it that you preserved the issue? Now, in turning the discussion to, he raised 5 of them, and he spoke specifically to the problem about the little girl not being interviewed by the court in chambers. His counsel...
They waived that because he said specifically there's no need to do that.
He bet I withdraw.
He says, yeah, I have one other issue. I discussed my client with my attorney and that regarding the in-camera interview. It's okay with them. We'll withdraw our request for an in-camera interview.
No so question.
The voice has been sufficiently heard. So that was withdrawn.
That's exactly what he said, Your Honor. And with regard to the other items that he put forth, first, to the question is, was there ample evidence to support the determination that she made that sole custody would be appropriate in this case? I can go through the evidence if you would like, Your Honor. Brief laid it out. But it goes through the fact that at the time of the hearing, he had just been convicted for a DWI. He drove to the courthouse with an interlock system in the car, which his daughter would be exposed to every time she drove there. He was obsessed with regard to golf. And you heard everything, every hour that he could calculate about how much of the time he had, he spent on the golf course. I'm a longtime golfer. I played in high school. I'm a member at Trump. I've been playing forever. And it's important to me. But I have two little girls. And you know what? Their interests are broad at this age. And this little girl is quite capable at many things. And to suggest that the court didn't have the authority to not ban her from golf. She didn't ban her from golf. She said you can play one time a week, 5.5 hours. That a week. We're not saying you can't spend time playing golf or that they're punishing you. It's just that you're going over the top. Now, he also was banned from being able to go to the gymnastics meets. Well, the evidence was presented that he disrupted the gymnastics classes when they were there and that it wasn't appropriate. In terms of the question that he then made later on about reopening the evidence, the part I just read to the court indicated that she had the benefit of the police report. He filed it in his motion to reopen, and he wanted to reopen for 2 points. One was for whatever the daughter would say, but didn't tell us it would be. And the other was, oh, there was this accusation. Well, the legal test here is not met, because it would require significant delay, because the case had not yet been tried. It was still pending, and that would have required the circuit court to hold the matter until it was addressed later on. What's also interesting in this is that the large mystery that we all know there must be an answer to, which is what happened at the trial when she was charged with assault. The record doesn't say it, right? But there's a reason why he hasn't mentioned it, and it's the temerity to actually argue it as a basis for an appeal when we know that he had no good faith basis to take that position to its ultimate conclusion. Right, this is a case which calls out for counsel fees in light of the fact that he has abused the system again. We're in a case where an abuse of discretion test applies to each of these, and he has not laid out even a good faith argument as to why he should prevail. His only argument is the court is the one that Judge Alston made, which is an argument or a discussion which a parent might reasonably hear from a judge saying, I'm trying not to throw blame on both of you. All right, I have to make a decision. And then she goes through the factors and identifies why it is the decision she took was appropriate. Right, it was not that I'm going to do something and there isn't any facts for it, so one of you has to lose. It was instead you went through the factors under 124.3 as she was required to do and did do. She made a rational decision, which was not an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, I have two questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
The first question is, no one cited the Eichelberger case.
Yeah, I am, and it was referred to in the cases as we read. I don't believe it was in the brief, and I did read it as well.
The case that discussed the extent to which a trial court could restrict the activities of a non-custodial parent on visitation.
I do recall Eichelberger, and I recall the further cases interpreting it, which was in one particular was the fellow wanted to teach his child German. And his complaint was that he was not allowed to teach the child German on the telephone. And the court's ruling was they can put reasonable restrictions on how you spend your time, but we can't override it. And it was the proof was that the children were unhappy about being taught German on the telephone. And the court found that was a reasonable restriction as it related to that process. In this instance, there's actual proof that the child was being harmed. And Eichelberger goes on to indicate that it's not that we can't tell you, but if there must be evidence that supports the determination that it's in the child's best interest.
Judge, let me follow up on our question.
I'm sorry, Ron. Oh, I apologize.
That's all right. My second question is, when did the order for the non-competitive participation in competitive golf, when did that occur?
All right, so this is an interesting question. Generally, courts in the equity side of the court, their rulings are effective on pronouncement. Right, whether or not we have an order that's entered that day or not, if we said you're not to do it any longer and you were in the courtroom and were told by the court it's effective that day. So the suggestion would be that would have been effective on May 2nd. There is another argument which one can make. If you're in the contempt area, whether or not you have notice of the order and were served with it or not, and there might be an argument that it's the later date, which is the entry of the order. But I think in this instance, it's likely from the pronouncement from the court, from the bench.
Is that your position?
It is my position, Judge. Now, to sum up, if you will, Your Honor, this is a case which I would suggest there is no significant legal question which has been raised. There is ample evidence before the court to support the determination made by Judge Irby on the main salient question, which is the award of custody to my client. And with regard to the restrictions that were put in place, the only question he raises, which is at all problematic, is whether or not it was required for the court to open the evidence again. And I would submit to you it was not required because it would have caused significant delay and problems in this case. It would not be over. And more importantly, it was cumulative. There was evidence which presented by the parties of an ongoing conflictual relationship where there were prior assaults which had been in place in which ultimately he'd been the person who'd been sent to jail for his behavior and also protective orders issued. In this case, there is no question but that there is ample evidence to support the determination made by the court, and certainly it should not abuse your discretion in any way in making the determination. Thank you very much.
We have about a minute.
Thank you very much. I'll try to make my points very brief and fire them off. First off, Mr. West noted a previous order. It was from 2009. There were some quite questionable areas where I broke her nose. I would just want to tell you that didn't happen. Just as she's done with four other orders that have been dismissed in the last 5 years, claims of stalking that I'm going to kill people or her and through her family. It's all just complete lies. And she wants to move to France. She's French. Côte d'Ivoire, she's from the south of France. Her dad's the REMAX of southern France. So that's what funds this continuing legal battle when I just want equitable time with my daughter. Okay. Second, the tasing. Florence didn't want to have a PC in 2012, parental coordinator. She said, I only want a woman. So that's what happened there. And we could never get one. Thus, we have a parental coordinator from Judge Irby, fired in November. I know this isn't part of the testimony, but it's important to show the temperament. Hence the motion to re-enter or reopen the case, because the assault class one misdemeanor is very, very important to this. And also, in terms of the motion to in-camera interview, Judge Irby states, quote, on page 570, I do not want to see any more motions indicating that Lauren has to speak with me because she wants X, Y, and Z. It smacks of bullying to me by your client.
All right, so
it shows obstinance and what I feel is abuse of discretion. So hopefully that lays things out. Hopefully you'll see it my way, and certainly this is what we want, Lauren and I, and that's why we've been doing it.
Thank you.
Coming out. Thank you.